Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula, Bill Russell, and President Marvin Krisloff. I can't go any farther without talking about this lawyer part, because I am thrilled that not only are you the president of Oberlin College, but you also come with your own wonderful education and your exciting experience as a lawyer at the University of Michigan, which I think is one of those lovely little nodes in your own life network. It's very important what you and the University of Michigan did for us in our democracy in defending the right to have affirmative action, the right to have affirmative action, and to think carefully about who gets educated in America. Wasn't that thrilling?
Well,
and hard.
It was a great honor for me to be part of the University of Michigan during that period in time. And as you know, what happened was we were sued. We at the University of Michigan were sued because of our admissions policy, which considered many, many different factors, primarily academic, but also geography, socioeconomic status, and so forth. But the piece we were sued about was the fact that there was some consideration of racial and ethnic diversity in order to try to get a critical mass of underrepresented minorities. And this was a policy that had been in effect for a very long time. And
reflected a lot of different people across the country. It wasn't like you did something weird.
No, in fact, after the Bakke case, which was 1978, most American universities and colleges implemented affirmative action programs that have been based on what was called the so-called Harvard Plan, where race and ethnicity was one plus factor, in addition to things like geography and socioeconomic status and so forth. And there was a legal challenge to our policies as well as others, but ours were the ones that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And one of the things that we did that I'm very proud of is we made a case about the importance of diversity in terms of achieving educational excellence, and that this exposure, similar to what we were just talking about, exposure to multiple points of view, including people from different racial and ethnic backgrounds, was very much a part of the educational experience and valuable for people from all backgrounds. And it was very compelling to the court. One of the things that they were very compelled by, the majority anyway, was the voices of the business community that said it was very important for business and economics to have perspectives and to be able to have interaction with people from different backgrounds. And one of the amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, was actually submitted by a lot of military brass, including people like Norman Schwarzkopf, just to name drop. And they said that the military, after the Vietnam experience, where there had been this disconnect between the enlisted folks and the officers on racial grounds, the military had begun a very conscious effort to integrate the officer corps, and that was partly done in their academies and partly done through ROTC as well. And so the military programs were very similar to the affirmative action programs. They were affirmative action programs seen at most of our nation's leading colleges and universities. And I think the court found this very compelling because the academies are similar to colleges and universities because they're national groups, elite, selective leadership training, and it is, as you suggested, so important for democracy to have this kind of integrated leadership and an integrated educational experience, if at all possible. And so this was a wonderful opportunity for me to be part of a historic moment. I think there are many other issues that still remain, and I think that one thing that we need to remember is affirmative action is really a very limited tool. It helps highly qualified people get into some of the elite schools, and it does produce some of our nation's greatest thinkers and leaders and so forth, but it is not a major social uplift program. It is really taking people who are very capable and giving them that extra opportunity, and to do so in an educational setting.
Listening to you, it brings me to the subject of justice, which is ultimately what this has to be about, the case has to be about. And justice has to do with opportunity more broadly. Justice has to go, at least socially, beyond what the letter of the law and even the intent of the law. And it seems that in that context, the role of the university or the college becomes very important because we would like to believe that everybody in the community has comparable opportunities. And of course, one of the arguments for affirmative action is that that historically and currently has not been the case. And it, and in some ways, it is, a to me, a wonderful example of the richness and complexity that the role of these institutions of higher learning, in some ways even more important than the primary and secondary schools, in some ways much less important, but the, those roles as exemplars, as laboratories, as vehicles for experimenting, for thinking through how we're going to grow and evolve into a more just society, a freer society, a more democratic society. Not to put all the burden on you, but it is, isn't it? Isn't that your job?
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this because this year in particular was a very competitive year for college admissions.
This was the year 2007-8, looking toward the class that starts 2008 and is the class of 2012?
It would be the starting in the fall of 2008, and so it would be the class of
12.
I wasn't a math major. But it would be the class of 2012.
I was pretty proud, and I'd already done my fingers and toes.
There
so.
You go. That's why you're the host, and I'm just the guest. But this was a big, this is the baby boom echo. So many people applying. And so we, along with most colleges and universities, selective colleges and universities, had record number of applications. And when you're making these choices, you are making very difficult decisions because you're looking at whole people and you're trying to merit is of course academic merit and potential is the most important thing, but you're also trying to get a class full of people who will be interesting and who will learn from each other, international. You want people who are studying different topics. You want some who are athletic. You want some people who are more artistic, and you want some people who are just all around good people and student leaders and so forth.
And what you decide makes a huge difference in their lives.
Absolutely, because there's the educational experience, which is transformative, which exposes people to different disciplines and so forth. But frankly, these colleges and universities are also part of networks. And we need to be realistic that this is part of the value of the education experience at this level is the networks of people, people like yourself, who one becomes part of that family when one goes to a place like an Oberlin or whatever selective school that you're at. And not just a selective school, but,
exactly.
but selective schools have been a conduit to access and to power. And if we look at, for instance, our presidential candidates on the Democratic side, for instance, both of those candidates went to highly selective schools and law schools. And you look in the lists of judges and senators and congresspeople and so forth, and disproportionately, those folks have gone to schools that are selective. And they can be public selective or private selective, but they are selective schools by and large. And that's why people are very anxious for their children and their grandchildren, because they know there is an impact, and it can be measured in economic terms of going to these places. I think,
and tremendous social terms as well as the economic.
Right, because
it shapes where we're going to go.
Well, and a lot of times you meet your spouse or partner at places like this and so forth. So the education itself is transformative, but the world of connections and family and friends that you become part of is also incredibly important.
Which is why we want those institutions to be broadly representative.
Absolutely.
Because if these elites, and that's what you're talking about, do not have experience with a much richer world than having grown up typically in an elite environment, unless we're very careful, and gone to an elite school and have friends who were comparably, blessed, then there is...
You end up with an aristocracy.
Well, you end up with an aristocracy, but it is a socially, culturally ignorant aristocracy, and you end up with, God help us, a governing class that has no visceral understanding of the governed, which in a democracy is a very dangerous thing.
When it is the governed who are supposed to be in charge.
Well, and the mobility that education, and particularly higher education, gives is so important to American democracy. And I can tell you that Oberlin College, which is where I am now president, has had a long tradition of providing that access. And of course, we were the first college to open our doors to people regardless of races and to women in a coeducational environment. And that commitment is very deep and very strong.
And goes back to 1835. 175 years is pretty good track record.
Right. We're celebrating our 175th anniversary this year. I'm very proud of that. And our commitment is backed up by a lot of money and resources. And so we continue to give very generous financial aid packages to people from lower and middle class families. And we reach out, and this year we've announced an initiative to eliminate loans for those students from Pell-eligible families. So these are families on the neediest side.
And eliminate the loans by giving them support.
Giving them money, flat-out money.
Yeah.
And we have a very strong record of providing access to Pell-eligible families and families who are working class but not quite eligible for Pell as well. It's incredibly important. And, you know, there are so many steps of the way that as we see the opportunity, it's important to help students from less affluent families get access to the educational opportunities, to internships, to graduate and professional schools. And so what Oberlin and schools like Oberlin can do is really provide an enormous opportunity, not just for one particular person, but really for a whole family. And I'm so... That's one of the things that really makes my heart
sing. I'm excited about it because I was one of those kids. And where were you when I needed... Well, somebody was there because I was able to have that experience. We're going to be back in just a moment with President Marvin Krisloff, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. We trust that you'll be with us. We are delighted to be with President Marvin Krisloff from Oberlin College, who has had vast experience in lots of different places. Bill Russell, I am Paula Gordon, and you haven't had much chance here.
I want to go back to affirmative action, because people have a fairly parochial view of that, and I am a, confessions of a an affirmative action baby. I am confident I know. I went to Stanford as essentially under an affirmative action.
He had all the grades, he had all the points, and...
Well, I was a Southerner, and Stanford didn't have a lot of Southerners.
Yep.
And for all I have some quarrels with the institution now and again, I am deeply appreciative of that perspective. And what they were looking for was geographic diversity at a time when that was not as common as it is now. But there were kids that were better qualified, that had better scores across the board than I did, in California particularly, better school systems.
Mm-hmm.
And they made allowance for the fact that there's more to education and to potential than the high school that you happen to be afflicted with, or the grades or the scores on tests. So this is not the simple stereotype that we tend to think of. This is a much richer idea and notion, and again, it's very important to a sense of fairness. Justice may be too big a word, of fairness in the overall community.
Well, and I didn't say lightly that I too had Oberlin in my case. Not looked through some of those, but I didn't have the grades that Bill had, and Oberlin could see something. The idea that we must be nurturing more than just this tiny elite that can afford it, that something. I know that your excitement, both about the ability to be reaching beyond the norm, if you will, and this access to education that has been a great block for just tons of people, that has to be thrilling.
It's absolutely thrilling. And, you know, I have a similar story because I grew up in Lexington, Kentucky, and although I did reasonably well, I was not... as well prepared and probably not as obviously credentialed as some people who may have been rejected. But one thing I did have is I had the passion and the desire, and it took me about a year and a half. But by that point, I think that my potential had been released, and I was able to do quite well. But it was hard. And one of the things that we as a college try to do, and we as a nation need to do, is to try to reach that potential in many, many people. And unfortunately, that's sometimes difficult to see, particularly if it's in a high school that is not so well known or is not so successful, at least from outward appearances. One of the things that I'm very proud of what Oberlin does is we have made a commitment to our local public schools. And one of the things we do is that any student who graduates there who's academically prepared gets a full free ride scholarship 4 years.
Fabulous. That's a new thing.
Which is enormous an enormous opportunity. And in fact,
because Oberlin is a very poor little town in its own way.
Right. There are many people there who do not have the kind of money to afford to pay the tuition without that kind of scholarship. And in fact, there's a really wonderful story. A young woman who lived in the surrounding area knew that she wanted to go to Oberlin, was attracted to the college, and asked her family to move to the town so that she could go to the high school and then could become eligible. And she's actually... she's done that. She's very accomplished, and she's going to Oberlin next year. And you know, it's just
that's
a wonderful
great.
Story.
Well, and of, all of that that northeastern part of Ohio, where Oberlin is in a swamp, I'm proud to say, having grown up next to a cattail marsh swamp, so I don't say that idly. That's the Rust Belt. You're not talking about you're not talking about Cambridge here. You're talking about northeast Ohio. And we haven't even mentioned that you have a world-renowned school of music as well. The conservatory enriches all of this in wonderful ways.
Absolutely. The conservatory has spawned some of the greatest leaders in music, including Atlanta's own Robert Spano and Alison Voldemort at the Atlanta Symphony, and many, many others. I just mentioned those.
You just happen to be here.
Because I'm in Atlanta, and they're very much on my mind. So thank you, Robert and Alison, for being wonderful Oberlin alums. But we offer something like 500 performances a year on Oberlin's campus, and the vast majority of them are free. And
music is a really important part of that experience. Even if, like me, you were in the library instead of in the concert hall listening, the very fact that music is honored as part of this liberal arts education, and you have the Allen Art Museum, which is world class.
Absolutely.
All of these pieces, yes, I know I sound like I am doing a commercial for Oberlin College. I don't mean that. I really don't mean that. What I mean to say is, all of these elements, wherever they are found, are essential to a rich, full life where democracy can flourish and people can reach their full potential.
Right. And one of the things I also should mention that we're working on is really Oberlin was recognized earlier this year by Sierra Club magazine as the number one coolest, meaning ecologically minded, school. And it is very important. We've been pioneers in the field of sustainability. Professor David Orr, who started our environmental studies program and is still very active at the school and a leader. We have the Adam Joseph Lewis Center, which is an iconic building which produces more energy than it uses. And it's a place where school children from all over the country come to see what we call the living machine. And we're looking at in enhancing our commitment to sustainability. We have a lot of locally grown food because there are farms in the area. And we do a lot of things with bikes and car sharing and trying to become carbon neutral. And that's a pledge that we have made. We were one of the first schools to make. So the sustainability and the connection between the town and the gown in terms of thinking about Oberlin as a model for a sustainable way of life is also very important to us and to the student body.
I have said to Professor Orr, and I don't say this lightly, that he is in many ways the Charles Finney of our time. Now, Charles Finney was a long time ago, 1835, but the passion at that time was around slavery and abolition, and Oberlin was all over that, and it was a very important, though small, part of a larger movement. And the environmental movement now is really a profound echo, in my opinion, of those liberation issues around bondage. And as we look forward, and David Orr is really eloquent talking about the bondage that we are imposing on those that come after us, if we're not right this moment being responsible on environmental issues. So this is not just, oh, and it's nice to be green. This isn't greenwash. Oh, everybody's doing it. This is important stuff.
Absolutely, and it's doing it in a way that really is trying to involve the whole community. One of the things
you mean the Oberlin itself,
Oberlin,
as well
the town, as well as the student body and the campus. And one of the things that I find particularly energizing about this is that the students are really driving a lot of these initiatives. So we just had the Echo Olympics to coincide with the Beijing Olympics, and the students had a dorm competition to see who can reduce the consumption. And they have these little orbs that I don't have it right in front of me, of course, but it showed whether or not people were using a lot of energy or they were reducing. And we're trying to monitor.
Is this a technical thing?
Yeah,
it's an orb.
It's an orb, and it flashes different colors. And red, I guess, is if you're using too much. And,
that's great.
And you know, some sort of other color if you're being
I'll bet it would
frugal.
Be green.
Green, presumably. Yes.
Just a guess.
Yes, I'm a little colorblind. I have a red green deficiency. So these color things.
I don't want to know this.
TMI. I understand. But anyway, they had these orbs, and there was a competition, and this is the kind of thing that the students are doing all the time to try to.
But you have something called
themselves.
A seed house.
Oh yes, we have a seed house, and my 7-year-old daughter and I went to visit. They're taking an older house on the sort of on the campus perimeter, and that was a combination of periphery and perimeter, and they're living there, and they're trying to reduce things like energy consumption and working on a garden and so forth. And again, this is all trying to create a model community in a way that not only, you know, one house in Oberlin, but as it spreads, as the idea spreads, and the Adam Joseph Lewis building, the idea has spread and been replicated and looked at by many, many other people internationally. The idea of trying to create this model of sustainable living that can be looked at by other communities, and we hope to make an influence on the world.
Your orb brings up an interesting notion to me. Metrics are very important. The orb is useful because it's a shorthand way of saying I'm winning, I'm losing. Mm. You know, sort of like a speedometer.
Is that like a one-handed lawyer?
No, it's different.
Sorry.
It's how you know whether the one-handed lawyer is giving you good advice.
I see.
But the notion of metrics more generally, and it goes back to what you were talking about admissions. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the criteria? And frequently we get trapped into very stupid metrics. Mm. You know, sometimes there are things that can be red or green. You know, yeah. They're essentially binary.
Yeah.
Red and or you can get sophisticated, red, green, and yellow, you know, partway there. There are other things that the variables, the number of variables is so much richer. And I go back to this admissions challenge. How do you decide? What are the criteria? And it used to, in the old days, it was, it was birth. In a newer incarnation, it was test scores and GPAs. And then we started getting a little smarter about it. But it seems to me one of the challenges, both within the local community, you know, how do you know you're succeeding with your students, with your faculty, with the community? Right. But more generally, as you look at these admission criteria, How do you develop these metrics? How do you know they're working? Where do they come from? How do you modify them? How do you test them?
All of which will be answered when we return in a moment with President Marvin Krislaw from Oberlin College. Bill Russell, thank you for that ability to go away. We'll come right back. Be with us when we return.